The American Revolution pleased lots of people, I suppose, but did not please everybody. In fact, some 75,000 at least Americans who were loyalists, that is to say, sided with the king and remained loyal to the British crown, had to accommodate to the new independent America. My guest tonight, Maya Jasanoff, is the author of a book about those people, Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary World. They were loyal to the crown. They were not loyal necessarily to the new administration in Philadelphia, were they?
No, they were not. They felt that their interests as Americans were very well served under the present arrangement that they were living under, whereby the colonies were governed in Britain. That's not to say, though, that they were stick-in-the-muds. It wasn't to say that they were entirely happy with everything that was going on. And in fact, many of the people who became outspoken loyalists or self-designated loyalists during the war were in fact in favor of various kinds of colonial reform in the years leading up to it. Many of them thought the Stamp Act, for example, was a very bad measure. And many of them had ideas of their own for how the colonial relationship should work going forward.
A crucial group were the Anglican clergy, who as such were pledged to eternal fealty to the head of the Anglican Church, who happened to be the King of England.
That's right. They were kind of in a double bind because they were loyal to their king, as civil subjects. But they also, of course, as you say, were members of a church whose head was the king. So it was sacrilegious as well as traitorous for them to renounce that.
Most of the loyalists, many of them, surely, left the country, left the new United States.
The majority of loyalists actually did not. The majority of loyalists stayed put for the, I think, fairly simple reason that most of us, when given a choice about what to do, will stay with what's familiar to us, what's known to us.
Reluctant Americans,
yes,
as it were.
Yeah, they became assimilated into the new republic.
But some 75,000 did leave.
That's right. So 60,000 loyalists, bearing with them about 15,000 slaves that they owned, left the colonies. And I think that given how much the pressure on an individual is to stay put, it's quite striking how many actually chose to leave. And this is about 1 in 40 members of the American population.
And their destinations were various, but all parts of the British Empire.
That's right. The British Empire in the years after the American Revolution was actually on a major upswing. And one of the paradoxes that I wanted to, perhaps the central paradox that I wanted to explore in this book through these people's lives was the question of how the British Empire went from suffering this huge loss in America, really its biggest imperial defeat until the era of World War II, how it went from that great loss to becoming the mightiest global power of the 19th century. And so following the loyalists gives us some insight into that.
Years ago, I met, indeed had, as a guest on this program, the Canadian novelist, do I have the name right, Margaret Atwood?
Yes.
And she is descended from loyalists who settled, I think originally in Nova Scotia, and she explained that they were still very proud of that heritage. That's 7 or 8 or 10 generations beyond.
That's right. It's the about half of the loyalist refugees settled in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick and other parts of Canada. And to go to those places today really is like going through the looking glass. You see in a place like Shelburne, Nova Scotia, which was really the boom town of the loyalist diaspora, a huge billboard at the entrance to the town saying, "Welcome to Shelburne, founded by United Empire Loyalists," with someone in a red coat welcoming you into the town. And, you know, compare with Massachusetts, for example, where I live, where it's full of horseshoes marking the ride of Paul Revere, and a very, very different kind of heritage.
And also on the fringes of Massachusetts and surely in New Hampshire, lots of people who've come down from Canada, mostly French-speaking Canadians.
That's right, yeah.
For a few years, I was up there in the middle of all of that in Hanover, New Hampshire, where half of the townspeople had more or less French names, though none of them spoke French anymore. But back to the diaspora. Actually, there are 3 or 4 different definable social groups. One is sort of English-speaking, middle-class, professionalized types, but who are the others?
The others are Native Americans who are...
Indians, as one used to say.
Yes, and as one sometimes still does say, actually, this terminology shifts. But
a member of your department once was required to stop teaching his course Stephen Thernstrom, because he spoke of Indians and his students were very offended by his not calling them Native Americans. They called him on the carpet, and the dean actually ordered Thernstrom, a distinguished historian, that he could not teach that course anymore.
Well, that would not happen anymore.
It's a however, footnote, but
yes.
I couldn't resist.
However, Indians is an ambiguous term for someone like me, who is a historian of the British Empire, and
sure.
Also talking about India. So
yeah.
To disambiguate, yes, to disambiguate.
Yes.
Many Native American Indians allied themselves with Britain during the war, and they had a very good reason to do it, which is that for generations up till that time, they had seen their lands encroached on by white settlers, and they had often come into conflict with these white settlers.
Particularly representatives of two major tribes, the Mohawks in the north and
the Creeks
and
in the south
in the
as
south.
Well. Yes,
yeah.
That's right. The Mohawks are really the most prominent of the loyal American Indian nations, and they had an alliance that dated back with Britain that was rather formalized, actually, in both personal relationships as well as treaties for a couple of decades before the American Revolution. And they, like many other loyalists, ended up becoming refugees at the end of the war, fleeing into present-day Ontario near Niagara and the town of Brantford, which was founded by their leader, Joseph Brant.
Whose Indian name was otherwise?
Yes.
If you remember it.
I remember it, although I hesitate to try to pronounce it. It was Thayendanegea.
Yeah. But he was a quite anglicized Indian, was he?
He was. His sister had married the superintendent of Indian Affairs in upstate New York, mm-hmm. an Irishman called Sir William Johnson, who had become a huge magnate in upstate New York and owned a vast amount of land and had a manor house at, called Johnson Hall, where he and his Mohawk wife presided. Joseph came into this milieu and was taken up by Sir William Johnson as a kind of protege, almost an adoptive son.
You are, as I have not yet, I think, indicated to our audience, a professor of history at Harvard University. The book that we're drawing from is Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary World. It's an interesting terrain that you've chosen for exploration. I don't think many people have actually mined that territory, to mix a metaphor. And I wonder how you came to it and what kind of work it required to produce this splendid new book. And we'll pursue those questions right after we pause for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to conversation with Maya Jasanoff. It's worth spelling that name because you're going to want to get your hands on this wonderful book. Jasanoff, Jasanoff. And the title of the book that we're drawing from, Liberty's Exiles, America's Loyalists in the Revolutionary World. The publishers, Alfred A. Knopf and Company, which testifies instantly to the quality of the book, they being really the most significant of all trade publishers in this country. You did a book earlier titled Edge of Empire. What was that one about?
Edge of Empire was an exploration of British imperial activity in the same period, but in India and in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to look at the lives of individuals who were caught up in the process of this incredible cultural collision, if nothing else, between Europeans and non-Europeans in Asia and the Middle East. And so I profiled the lives of art collectors who were living on imperial frontiers and gathering objects.
Why of art collectors?
Because I was struck at the time that I wrote the book, I began the project in the late 90s, at how much talk there was in those days about a clash of civilizations and mm-hmm. how often that kind of discussion was framed in terms of discourses of otherness, to use a very academic kind of phrase. And I wanted to look at the concrete. I wanted to look at how it really was that people interacted, what it really was that they saw of other cultures and that they could take back home with them, which is really something special about art objects, which then go on to have lives of their own in museums and private collections and more.
You wanted to see how it really was.
Yes.
Wie es eigentlich gewesen war. You know that phrase?
I do.
Which is the historian's creed from an earlier period, to tell it the way it really was.
That's right, that's right.
Is that ever possible?
No.
Of course not. Fodorenko was wrong.
Yes, I think Raqqa has been proven to be wrong to the extent that anyone is, merely in the sense of what historians aim to achieve these days is not the same sort of totalizing truth that Raqqa aspired to.
I'm fascinated by history, and I'm a psychologist, not an historian, but I read a certain amount of history, and I often wonder, how do historians come to their periods? How do you decide where you're going to live for much of the rest of your professional life?
Well, I ask myself this question quite a bit as well, so historians are capable of these queries too. For me, I think I was drawn to the history of the British Empire for a variety of reasons, both personal and intellectual. And in the course of my studies of that, I became very drawn to this period because it seemed to me to, in fact, contain many paradoxes of the kind I've already explained undergirds Liberty's exiles. But one of the things I was really keen to look at was how this empire came into being. And that was one of the inspirations for my first book as well. So the late 18th century is really a fabulously rich time to think about the beginnings of the modern world.
How did the British Empire come into being? Are there rules so that all empires, as they are developing, are intrinsically following without their knowing that they're doing so? Is Crane Brinton, a famous Harvard historian of a much, much earlier period, did a book, The Anatomy of Revolution. There are certain regularities about all revolutions. Is there an anatomy of empire building as well?
You know, this is a question people always come back to, and I think it's fairly hard to come up with a kind of global and transtemporal anatomy of empire. But there are, of course, certain analogies that can be drawn. I think for me, the thing that really stands out is that empires tend to be built on top of one another. You know, empires are the oldest form of government in world history. And even though the word is unfashionable for describing present-day political configurations, I think a lot of people would agree, if they looked closely, that we still live with imperial forms. And because empires have been with us forever, they've also been sort of stacked on top of one another. And so one of the things that I found particularly fascinating about the British Empire in the late 18th century is the degree to which, particularly in those early years of British state formation in a place like India, they're really borrowing on indigenous Mughal imperial traditions and inserting themselves into
Mughal.
That.
Explain to the world what Mughal
So
means.
The Mughal Empire was the dominant power in most of northern and central India, dating back to the Middle Ages up until the British arrived. In fact, the last Mughal emperor was only unseated after the Indian Mutiny in 1858.
They are the people who brought Islam down to the Indian continent. Or subcontinent.
They're the people most strongly associated with it, yes. And they're the builders of the Taj Mahal, for example.
And of all the fine cuisine of northern India.
Yes, that you will see in most restaurants that you go to.
But the British Empire, the key to it, there were two areas, I suppose, of greatest importance in establishing the significance of the British Empire and its wealth. India was one, and surely the American colonies were the other.
Yes. In fact, the American colonies in general, yes, but Jamaica more particularly, and the Caribbean colonies more particularly, because it was there that the most valuable product in the 18th century British Empire, at least in the Atlantic world, was cultivated, and that was sugar.
Yeah.
And sugar made Jamaica, in fact, the wealthiest colony in the British Empire in the 18th century.
And it was there that they needed lots of very, very cheap, essentially, quote, free labor.
Yes.
That's slavery.
That's right. So there's a famous triangle trade that involves the bringing of slaves to the Caribbean and the bringing of sugar to the 13 colonies and to Britain itself. And this economic circuit was, again, one of the great sources of wealth for the British Empire, also the French Empire, and also the Spanish Empire to a degree in the same period.
There have been 100 books, and at least 20 of them have been represented on this program over the years, about the making of the American Revolution. And arguing about or conjuring and conjecturing over what stimulated the American Revolution. What's your one-minute capsule answer to that question?
I think, seen from a British point of view, the American Revolution basically comes out of an attempt by Britain to balance the needs of the parts of its growing empire. And so you see in the years after the Seven Years' War, which we call here the French and Indian War, which ends in 1763 with a great victory for Britain, enormous amounts of land acquired in Canada, the province of Quebec in particular, and also in India. The British Empire expands a lot, but it also has new needs that go with that. It has new borders to defend. It has to pay for an army to do that. And it has different interest groups that it has to placate. So what you see the British doing in the 1760s and 70s, which is the period when the American crisis is really brewing, is attempting to balance out what East India Company merchants need in India, what West Indian sugar planters need in Jamaica, what American colonists need in Massachusetts and Virginia, what French Catholic subjects of the British Empire in Quebec need. And so I think these are the things that go into the making of the American Revolution from a British imperial point of view. And the kind of resistance that you see put up by American colonists actually resembles the type of resistance that you see in other places in the British Empire, that you see even, amazingly enough, among loyalist refugees after the Revolution. So it's a classic set of problems of an imperial power trying to deal with a bunch of very disparate imperial subjects.
Let us come to those loyalist refugees. Those are the people that your book focuses upon, of course. And it's delightful to find very close case studies of a few representative people, representative figures. Let's choose one, your choice.
We could talk about David George, perhaps.
Let's do that.
David George represented the third group of loyalists that you asked me about before, alongside the whites, alongside the Indians. There were also 20,000 black slaves who earned their freedom from Britain by agreeing to fight on the British side.
You say that they were slaves of patriot owners, patriot meaning revolutionaries.
Yes, they were.
How did they get away from their owners to enroll in British regiments?
They literally ran away, and it was much easier for them to run away to the British when the British happened to be, for example, on a ship in the Chesapeake a few miles away from their plantation, or when the British happened to be marching through their owner's land. This facilitated the slaves running away.
And one of the characters in your book issues a general edict or order or offer telling all slaves, if they volunteer to serve with the British, they will be free.
That's right. The first invitation to slaves was issued by the then governor of Virginia, called Lord Dunmore, who about 6 months after the revolution began, in November, really, of 1775, issued this declaration inviting patriot-owned slaves to defect, basically, to the British. And this promise elicited the first great wave of runaways, but it was followed by repetitions of the promise by other British commanders.
How were they used by the British in the war?
A lot of them, so some of them were formed into military regiments. Dunmore created a regiment called the Ethiopian Regiment. There was also one called the Black Pioneers. So a number of them became actual soldiers in arms. Many also became provisioners and wagoners and people working in service capacities to the troops as well.
Now, our particular man is?
David George.
Let's focus on him.
So David George had already run away as an adolescent from a very harsh master in Virginia. He'd run away to the backcountry of South Carolina, where he was owned by a fairly tolerant master who, among other things, allowed him to attend religious services. And David George had become a convert to baptism. He was a very charismatic preacher himself. And when the British marched through the backcountry in a campaign during the war, David George and about 90 others in his plantation ran away to join them. And that was the beginning of what would end up being a really remarkable exodus for George, which he envisioned in the terms of an exodus, partly because he also he was so infused with religious language, and he went from place to place, starting up new congregations wherever he went.
He's a fascinating figure. We will follow his fortunes directly. We return after we pause for an update on the news.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
Our guest tonight is Maya Jasanoff, professor of history at Harvard University, author of a fascinating new book titled Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary World, and Alfred A. Knopf, the publishers. Let's return to the fortunes of our ex-slave.
So David George joined the British and became a sort of affiliate of the British Army in Savannah and in Charleston. And when the British evacuated from the colonies, which is the way in which the vast majority of loyalists ended up leaving, they went on the British ships with the British soldiers at the end of the war, David George joined the flight. And he ended up going to Nova Scotia, which was the number one site of loyalist refuge, and there made his way to Shelburne, as I already mentioned, the loyalist boomtown of Nova Scotia, which went from being nothing to having a population of some 10 or 12,000 virtually overnight. David George settled there because he figured this would be a fertile ground, among other things, for his Baptist preaching, which was really something he saw as a mission. And he began to preach in Shelburne. He discovered there, though, that for all that the British had made promises of freedom to the slaves, such as him, and had honored those promises by allowing them to leave. Nevertheless, conditions in Nova Scotia were not all that they might be for the black loyalists. They were granted land, like white loyalists, by the British government, but often that land was very badly located, hard to claim, and other kinds of tensions swirled around this community, including racial...
Nova Scotia, in fact, climatologically, is a very raw place.
It is. It's a very difficult place. Yeah. And, you know, in the first winter that the refugees were there, in fact, the black loyalists had arrived sufficiently late and with sufficiently few provisions for all that the British were helping them, that when they created shelters for themselves, they had to dig down into the ground and create these kind of dugouts because they didn't really have time or materials to put up better shelter. So George finds himself in this place, free, but confronted with degrees of racial prejudice. People try to prevent him from baptizing whites. And ultimately, in the summer of 1784, there's a big riot in Shelburne, which chases him out of town and really shows the degree of racial animosity. This riot is directed in part against the black residents there. And so conditions continue to be rather rough for the whites as well as for the blacks, but the blacks are at a special disadvantage. But the next and perhaps most remarkable phase of David George's exodus will come when, in 1791, a way out of this situation is held forward for the black loyalists. It comes from Britain. It comes from British abolitionists who have really gained ground in the wake of the American Revolution and who want to start up a new colony for free blacks in Africa. The idea being that they can undercut the slave trade by doing this.
In Sierra Leone.
Yes, they settle on the idea of settling free blacks in Sierra Leone. So they have the plan, they have the money, they have the ships, they have someone to organize it, but they need the settlers. And this is where David George and his community come in.
And the town that they settle there is called Freetown.
That's right. So David George, his parishioners, and about 1,200 black loyalists go on this expedition from Nova Scotia to found the city of Freetown, Sierra Leone. It's the first such scheme, the first, I would say, back to Africa movement in modern history.
It's equivalent to what we did from this country directly after, even before the Civil War, with Liberia.
Yes, so Freetown becomes the inspiration for Liberia, in fact, which is founded about a generation later.
And Liberia means the place for liberated slaves, and they named their capital for James Monroe, Monrovia. It hasn't worked out all that well in Liberia. How well did it work out in Sierra Leone?
You know, it's very easy to look at the case of Sierra Leone and feel depressed because of the civil war that was so devastating that, that many people may remember the ghastly images from. And it remains one of the two or three poorest countries in the world, according to the UN Human Development Index. That said, I think we need to be careful as historians not to read the present back into the past and to remember that actually Freetown, you know, in the early 19th century, Freetown was a place to be copied. That's how Liberia came into being. Freetown was a place that grew with a quite cosmopolitan community of former freed slaves. Freetown was the site of a major university, which still exists, that was founded in the 19th century. So, you know, of course, the recent history of these regions has been really calamitous. But we shouldn't forget the utopian spirit in which they were founded.
In Liberia, though, the American former slaves composed an imposed aristocracy, and they remained as such Did something similar happen then in Sierra Leone? Or did they assimilate and blend with the native population?
Sierra Leone remained a British colony, but there was a bit of a distinction between Freetown and the hinterland. Freetown was the place where the former slaves settled. The hinterland has its own indigenous peoples who... the different communities remained somewhat distinct.
Does that hold down to this generation?
Now there's a bit of a change in the sense that so the language that was spoken by the former freed slaves was called Creole. The word is the same as Creole.
Sure.
It was a kind of common language that they found amongst themselves. They all hailed from different parts of West Africa, different parts of the Americas and the Atlantic world. So Creole became a kind of lingua franca among the residents of Freetown, among the former slaves, and it has now spread in Sierra Leone to become much more of a lingua franca in the country as a whole. So in that sense, you can see the influence spreading.
You visited there, Shirley.
I did.
How's your Creole?
Not too good, I'm afraid.
Is that the larger portion of the black diaspora, or do loyalist blacks still persist in Canada as well?
Many of the black loyalists in Canada left, about a third or a bit more than a third of them left on the Sierra Leone expedition.
But the rest stayed.
The rest stayed, and in fact, some historians have pointed to the black loyalists as really the beginnings of a much more substantial black Canadian population that comes down to us today. They were followed in Nova Scotia by the arrival of another black population from Jamaica, the Jamaican Maroons, who settled in some of the very villages that the black loyalists had left behind in the 1790s. Only then themselves to go to Sierra Leone as well. So you can see here the British Empire kind of creating immigration routes, which they reused, and some of which actually remain in place today.
The other basic population of Nova Scotia is essentially Scots, Scotch immigrants from much earlier on.
Nova Scotia was originally settled by French Canadians, French colonists called the Acadians.
Yeah, and they're displaced to Louisiana.
The Acadians were displaced in the 1750s by the British. And one of the reasons that there was a lot of land available in Nova Scotia for the loyalist refugees is precisely because the Acadians had been dislocated, expelled. But the British government had been relatively unsuccessful at attracting other settlers to go there. And so they kept on hoping that Nova Scotia would be kind of the next big thing in the Americas. And it never really took off. And so they welcomed the loyalist refugees as a chance to get the population kick-started.
What memories transmitted across the generations in family lore or whatever, what memories of America persist among the modern descendants of the loyalists?
In Canada, I think there continues to be a strong loyalist tradition. People are aware of their loyalist roots, and it's part
like
of the history of
like
Nova
Margaret
Scotia. Exactly,
memories,
like Margaret
Atwood. Earlier.
And in fact, one of the nice things about writing this book has been that many people have written to me saying, you know, my ancestors were loyalists, and I knew very little about this history until now. That said, one of the things I was struck by in the course of my research was actually how little sense of a kind of folklore there was knitting together the different loyalist refugee communities once you get about a generation out from the revolution. So in this sense, it's unlike other kinds of diasporic communities we may be familiar with. It's unlike, for example, the sort of lost cause legend that's sustained by Southerners after the Civil War. And I found myself wondering why this was so. And the conclusion that I reached was that really the Loyalists had no reason to sustain this legend because they had gone from one part of the British Empire to another. They remained British subjects all the way through. And the British Empire itself was on a strong upward trajectory. The British Empire was in a much better place by the end of their lives than it was at the beginning.
One thing we haven't talked about yet, though, is very vividly represented in your book, is the savage treatment many of them had during and even after the success of the Revolution from the Patriots.
We often forget that the American Revolution was a civil war, and people who lived through it characterized it as a civil war, and so they should have, because they knew it was based on the violence that they saw or feared in their own backyards. And so patriots would come and ask people to sign or swear an oath or something to join their cause. And if you refused, then you might find yourself on the receiving end of various forms of state or popular justice.
Including some murders and killings?
Yeah, the most notorious or infamous kind of punishment meted out to loyalists is that of tarring and feathering, which still springs to mind for many people when they think of loyalists. It was not hugely widespread, but it was there, and it was an awful thing to have happen to you. More common was property confiscation, banishment, again, various types of harassment. So, for example, people might have their windows smashed, or they might have their livestock poisoned. They might, find themselves attacked by mobs in their home.
We return in just a moment. The one group we haven't talked about yet are those more or less Anglo-Saxon American loyalists who went back to England. And some of them had significant careers in England and even in advancing the further fortunes of the British Empire. We'll return to conversation with Maya Jasanoff, author of Liberty's Exiles, after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And back to the Loyalists, the Loyalist diaspora around the world, if not all the world, surely in the world of the British Empire. We're talking with Maya Jasanoff, and we're drawing from her excellent and utterly readable and really quite engrossing new book, Liberty's Exiles. And let's come to the Americans who went back to become Brits. And foremost among them, perhaps, in your book, because it's such an interesting case, is Elizabeth Johnston. Let's talk about her.
Sure. Elizabeth Johnston was just a girl when the war began. She was about 12. And the revolution arrived in her life when a patriot mob came to her father's doorstep on their plantation in Georgia, wanted him to join their cause. He didn't. And instead, he ran away and joined the British Army. During the course of the war, Elizabeth Johnston grew up some enough to fall in love with one of her father's brother officers, whom she married, a man called William Johnston. And together they began a new married life against the backdrop of this British defeat. And so they migrated a number of times following the British forces out of America. They settled initially in East Florida, which was a British colony at that time, which was held out as an asylum to loyalists until they learned, very much to their chagrin, that East Florida would be handed over to Spain, according to the peace treaty. And so the Johnstons and another many thousand loyalist refugees had to leave again. It was at this point that they chose to go to Britain. Many people ask me with this topic, well, didn't all the loyalists just go back to Britain? And my answer is always, well, actually, no, only about 15% went to Britain, and it wasn't back for most of them, because very few of them had ever been to Britain in the first place. And this was the case for the Johnstons. They had never been there before. William Johnston and Elizabeth Johnston and their couple of small children settled in Edinburgh in Scotland for the reason that Edinburgh had the best medical school in the Atlantic world, and William Johnston was a medical student. And there they really started.
It's still one of the best.
It is, although I think a few universities on this side of the water would probably rival them a bit now. In those days, though, Edinburgh definitely beat Philadelphia, which is where William had studied before the war. And so the Johnstons settle there while William Johnston pursues his medical degree. What they find, though, is what many refugees find in Britain, which is that it is an alien place. It's a place they don't have many friends in. It's a place where their connections are not so good. It's a place where they are comparatively poor, especially because they've lost so much during the war. And so it is that once William Johnston gets his training finished, they actually choose to move on again. And this was a decision made by many loyalists who felt unable to kind of make a go of it in Britain in anything like the condition of life that they had enjoyed back in the colonies.
How did their life unfold from there on?
So the Johnstons ended up going to the richest colony in the British Empire, and that was Jamaica. Mm-hmm. Jamaica was a very alluring place because of its wealth. But the same things that made it alluring also made it quite a challenging place to live. All of the sugar grown on Jamaica was cultivated by huge numbers of black slaves who outnumbered the whites by a ratio of something like 8-1, which meant that the small white population lived in great fear of their own slaves. They were afraid of slave rebellions. It was a very violent place where the slaves were kind of kept in check by incredible brutality. And it was also a place that very lush and beautiful though it is, was filled with diseases that were totally unknown to or unfamiliar to, I should say, the bodies of the Europeans who arrived there. This meant it was a great place for William Johnston to find work, but it also meant that for many whites who went to Jamaica, it could be quite a fatal place because there was so much yellow fever, also to be found at that time on the American mainland, but more endemic in Jamaica. There was malaria. There were all kinds of other diseases. And so the Johnstons settle in Jamaica. William finds work, but Elizabeth is one of really a handful of white women living on Jamaica, feels very isolated, tries to raise a family in this very dangerous place, and watches the family effectively fall apart. They lose a couple of children to illness. They end up sending other children to Britain, where they think they'll be safer living with family members in that climate. And ultimately, Elizabeth Johnston herself decides to leave her husband and go live in Britain for her health as well. So it turns out to be a very trying place for them, a false refuge in the end.
I'm trying to remember the story of Benjamin Franklin's son. Was he? He wasn't a loyalist as such, but he tended, or was he?
He was, you know, back to the question of how this was a civil war. It divided families, and
but he did not fight on the British side.
Well, he was a declared loyalist. One of the best known family that was divided by the Revolution was that of the Franklins.
Yeah, yeah.
So Benjamin is a well-known patriot. William Franklin was the last royal governor of New Jersey. And at the time the war broke out, he was governor of New Jersey. He was actually imprisoned by the patriots for a while in Connecticut for refusing to join the patriot cause. He then, after his release, went to New York, which was the biggest British stronghold during the war, and became there a leader of the loyalist community in New York, and was responsible for helping to organize loyalist militias and raids into the countryside and all of that kind of thing. He was a very active loyalist, and ultimately left and went to Britain as well, where he spent the rest of his rather long life in more or less chagrin about what he had lost, and with an incurable rift with his father. The two of them barely ever spoke again. Benjamin Franklin largely wrote William Franklin out of his will, and there was enormous discontent in that family.
Was that true of any other major American families who played a role in the Revolution? The Adamses all remain surely loyal to the Revolution.
Yeah, the Franklins are the ones who really stand out. I think, though, that said, it's important to remember that John Adams himself said, as a sort of back-of-the-envelope estimate, that at the time that the Revolution began, a third of the population was loyal, a third was on the fence, and a third were patriots. Well, that means that a minority of the population were patriots at the beginning of the war, in Adams's estimation, and it meant that a lot of people were kind of on the fence. And so, you know, even in a prominent patriot family such as George Washington's, you know, one could imagine that there would be cousins and outliers and all the rest of it, who were at least on the fence while they could see what would happen.
Would one count Benedict Arnold as a sort of late-blooming loyalist?
Yeah, Benedict Arnold, the great traitor in American ideology.
In our definition of him.
Yes, actually.
How did the British define him?
Well, Benedict Arnold ended up going over and becoming, of course, a British general, where he served them reasonably well.
The other side of the Revolution.
He did. And after the war, Benedict Arnold again joined this flight and went to Britain for a bit. He went to New Brunswick for a bit to start up a business. The most interesting spinoff of the Benedict Arnold family that I encountered is that two of his sons actually joined a smallish community of loyalists, American-born people, who ended up going into the service of the East India Company and making their way to India. And it was there that two of Arnold's sons spent their careers, their professional lives as soldiers in the East India Company army, marrying Indian women, in one case having a half-Indian daughter, which left me very fascinated at the idea that there was the sprig of the Arnold family actually as far afield as India.
Historians necessarily, though they are focused in the concrete details of their particular periods and their particular subjects and even their particular historical actors, as you are in all of this, search for some kind of more applicable or generalizable meaning. which applies beyond the circumstantial source of their work. Do you find any such in this work?
I do.
What do we learn from this that is useful to us?
I think we learn things both about our nation and national history, and then also I think about aspects of human experience.
Mm-hmm.
So on the second point first, I think one of the things I was most struck by in studying these people is how often they moved more than once. And the Johnston family that I was discussing earlier is a very good example of this. I should say their journey only ended, Elizabeth Johnston's migrations only ended about 3 decades after they began, when she finally settled in Nova Scotia with her surviving children and flourished there. But this was 30 years of a life on the go. And it made me reflect on the degree to which migration can be a recurring phenomenon, especially when it is not begun entirely out of your own choice. And I think that there's a story here in these loyalist refugees of that may be applicable to other kinds of questions of migration and movement around the world.
If you will allow me to render a judgment, I'm not one of your colleagues in history at Harvard, a mere emeritus psychologist from the University of Chicago, but I think this is one of the best works of history done at a popular level that I've read in a long, long time. The book by Maya Jasanoff is titled Liberties, Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary World. Alfred A. Knopf, the publishers, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.